Chapter 7. The hands of these messengers of hope. This occupation gave him a fresh lease of patience, and he now lived only to watch for the visitor's days, and scan the faces that swept by him like stars seen and lost in the rifts of a hurrying sky. Mostly, these faces were strange, and less intelligent than those of his companions. But they represented his last means of access to the world, a kind of subterranean channel on which he could set his statements afloat, like paper boats which the mysterious current might sweep out into the open seas of life. One day, however, his attention was arrested by a familiar contour, a pair of bright prominent eyes, and a chin insufficiently shaved. He sprang up and stood in the path of Peter McCarron. The journalist looked at him doubtfully, then held out his hand with a startled deprecating, "Why, you didn't know me. I'm so changed." Grannis faltered, feeling the rebound of the other's wonder. "Why, no, but you're looking quieter, smoothed out," McCarron smiled. "Yes, that's what I'm here for, to rest. And I've taken the opportunity to write out a clearer statement." Grannis's hand shook, so that he could hardly draw the folded paper from his pocket. As he did so, he noticed that the reporter was accompanied by a tall man with grave, compassionate eyes. It came to Grannis in a wild thrill of conviction that this was the face he had waited for. "Perhaps your friend he is your friend? Would glance over it, or I could put the case in a few words, if you have time." Grannis's voice shook like his hand. If this chance escaped him, he felt that his last hope was gone. McCarron and the stranger looked at each other, and the former glanced at his watch. "I'm sorry we can't stay and talk it over now, Mr. Grannis, but my friend has an engagement, and we're rather pressed." Grannis continued to proffer the paper. I'm sorry, I think I could have explained. But you will take this, at any rate?" The stranger looked at him gently. "See, certainly I'll take it." He had his hand out. "Gee, goodbye." "Goodbye," Grannis echoed. He stood watching the two men move away from him through the long light hall, and as he watched them a tear ran down his face. But as soon as they were out of sight, he turned and walked hastily toward his room, beginning to hope again, already planning a new statement. Outside the building, the two men stood still, and the journalist's companion looked up curiously at the long, monotonous rows of barred windows. "So that was Grannis?" "Yes, that was Grannis, poor devil," said McCarron. "Strange case. I suppose there's never been one just like it? He's still absolutely convinced that he committed that murder?" "Absolutely. Yes," the stranger reflected. "And there was no conceivable ground for the idea? No one could make out how it started? A quiet, conventional sort of fellow like that, where do you suppose he got such a delusion? Did you ever get the least clue to it?" McCarron stood still, his hands in his pockets, his head cocked up in contemplation of the barred windows. Then he turned his bright, hard gaze on his companion. "That was the queer part of it. I've never spoken of it, but I did get a clue. By Jove! That's interesting. What was it?" McCarron formed his red lips into a whistle. "Why, that it wasn't a delusion." He produced his effect. The other turned on him with a pallid stare. "He murdered the man all right. I tumbled on the truth by the merest accident, when I'd pretty nearly chucked the whole job." "He murdered and murdered his cousin?" "Sure as you live. Only don't split on me. It's about the queerest business I ever ran into." "Do about it? Why, what was I to do? I couldn't hang the poor devil, could I? Lord, but I was glad when they collared him, and had him stowed away safe in there." The tall man listened with a grave face, grasping Grannis's statement in his hand. "Here, take this. It makes me sick," he said abruptly, thrusting the paper at the reporter, and the two men turned and walked in silence to the gates. His father's son, after his wife's death, Mason Grew took the momentous step of selling out his business and moving from Wingfield, Connecticut, to Brooklyn. For years he had secretly nursed the hope of such a change, but had never dared to suggest it to Mrs. Gru, a woman of immutable habits. Mr. Gru himself was attached to Wingfield, where he had grown up, prospered, and become what the local press described as prominent. He was attached to his ugly brick house with sandstone trimmings, and a cast iron area railing neatly sanded to match, to the similar row of houses across the street, the trolley wires forming a kind of aerial pathway between, and the sprawling vista close by the steeple of the church which he and his wife had always attended, and where their only child had been baptized. It was hard to snap all these threads of association, visual and sentimental, yet still harder, now that he was alone, to live so far from his boy. Ronald Gru was practicing law in New York, and there was no more chance of returning to live at Wingfield than of a river's flowing inland from the sea. Therefore, to be near him his father must move, and it was characteristic of Mr. Gru, and of the situation generally, that the translation, when it took place, was to Brooklyn, and not to New York. "Why you bury yourself in that hole, I can't think," had been Ronald's comment, and Mr. Gru simply replied that rents were lower in Brooklyn, and that he had heard of a house that would suit him. In reality, he had said to himself, being the only recipient of his own confidences, that if he went to New York he might be on the boy's mind, whereas, if he lived in Brooklyn, Ronald would always have a good excuse for not popping over to see him every other day. The sociological isolation of Brooklyn, combined with its geographical nearness, presented in fact the precise conditions for Mr. Gru's case. He wanted to be near enough to New York to go there often, to feel under his feet the same pavement that Ronald trod, to sit now and then in the same theaters, and find on his breakfast table the journals which, with increasing frequency, inserted Ronald's name in the sacred bounds of the society column. It had always been a trial to Mr. Gru to have to wait 24 hours to read that among those present was Mr. Ronald Gru. Now he had it with his coffee, and left it on the breakfast table to the perusal of a hired girl cosmopolitan enough to do it justice. In such ways Brooklyn attested the advantages of its propinquity to New York, while remaining, as regards Ronald's duty to his father, as remote and inaccessible as Wingfield. It was not that Ronald shirked his filial obligations, but rather because of his heavy sense of them, that Mr. Gru so persistently sought to minimize and lighten them. It was he who insisted, to Ronald, on the immense difficulty of getting from New York to Brooklyn. "Any way you look at it, it makes a big hole in the day, and there's not much use in the ragged rim left. You say you're dining out next Sunday? Then I forbid you to come over here for lunch. Do you understand me, sir? You disobey at the risk of your father's malediction. Where did you say you were dining? With the Waltham Bankshires again? Why, that's the second time in 3 weeks, ain't it? Big blowout, I suppose? Gold plate and orchids opera singers in afterward? Well, you'd be in a nice box if there was a fog on the river and you got hung up halfway over. That'd be a handsome return for the attention Mrs. Bankshire has shown you singling out a whippersnapper like you twice in 3 weeks. What's the daughter's name, Daisy? No, sir, don't you come fooling round here next Sunday, or I'll set the dogs on you. And you wouldn't find me in anyhow, come to think of it. I'm lunching out myself, as it happens, yes sir, lunching out. Is there anything especially comic in my lunching out? I don't often do it, you say? Well, that's no reason why I never should. Who with? Why, with old Dr. Bleeker. Dr. Liphalet Bleeker. No, you wouldn't know about him, he's only an old friend of your mother's and mine. Gradually Ronald's insistence became less difficult to overcome. With his customary sweetness and tact, as Mr. Gru put it, he began to ache the hint, to give in to the old gentleman's growing desire for solitude. "I'm set in my ways, Ronnie, that's about the size of it. I like to go tick-ticking along like a clock. I always did. And when you come bouncing in, I never feel sure there's enough for dinner, or that I haven't sent Maria out for the evening. And I don't want the neighbors to see me opening my own door to my son. That's the kind of cringing snob I am. Don't give me away, will you? I want them to think I keep 4 or 5 powdered flunkies in the hall day and night, same as the lobby of one of those Fifth Avenue hotels. And if you pop over when you're not expected, how am I going to keep up the bluff? Ronald yielded after the proper amount of resistance is intuitive sense. In every social transaction, of the proper amount of force to be expended, was one of the qualities his father most admired in him. Mr. Grew's perceptions in this line were probably more acute than his son suspected. The souls of short, thick-set men, with chubby features, mutton-chop whiskers, and pale eyes peering between folds of fat like almond kernels in half-split shells, souls thus encased do not reveal themselves to the casual scrutiny as delicate emotional instruments. But in spite of the dense disguise in which he walked, Mr. Grew vibrated exquisitely in response to every imaginative appeal. And his son Ronald was perpetually stimulating and feeding his imagination. Ronald, in fact, constituted his father's one escape from the impenetrable element of mediocrity which had always hemmed him in. To a man so enamored of beauty, and so little qualified to add to its sum total, it was a wonderful privilege to have bestowed on the world such a being. Ronald's resemblance to Mr. Grew's early conception of what he himself would have liked to look might have put new life into the discredited theory of prenatal influences. At any rate, if the young man owed his beauty, his distinction, and his winning manner to the dreams of one of his parents, it was certainly to those of Mr. Grew, who, while outwardly devoting his life to the manufacture and dissemination of Grew's secure suspender buckle, moved in an enchanted inward world peopled with all the figures of romance. In this high company, Mr. Grew cut as brilliant a figure as any of its noble phantoms. And to see his vision of himself suddenly projected on the outer world in the shape of a brilliant, popular, conquering son, seemed, in retrospect, to give to that image a belated objective reality. There were even moments when, forgetting his physiognomy, Mr. Grew said to himself that, if he'd had alpha chance, he might have done as well as Ronald, but this only fortified his resolve that Ronald should do infinitely better. Ronald's ability to do well almost equaled his gift of looking well. Mr. Grew constantly affirmed to himself that the boy was not a genius, but, barring this slight deficiency, he was almost everything that a parent could wish. Even at Harvard he had managed to be several desirable things at once: writing poetry in the college magazine, playing delightfully wire, acquitting himself honorably in his studies, and yet holding his own in the fashionable sporting set that formed, as it were, the gateway of the temple of society. Mr. Grew's idealism did not preclude the frank desire that his son should pass through that gateway, but the wish was not prompted by material considerations. It was Mr. Grew's notion that, in the rough and hurrying current of a new civilization, the little pools of leisure and enjoyment must nurture delicate growths, material graces as well as moral refinements, likely to be uprooted and swept away by the rush of the main torrent. He based his theory on the fact that he had liked the few society people he had met and found their manners simpler, their voices more agreeable, their views more consonant with his own than those of the leading citizens of Wingfield. But then he had met very few. Ronald's sympathies needed no urging in the same direction. He took naturally, dauntlessly, to all the high and exceptional things about which his father's imagination had so long sheepishly and ineffectually hovered from the start. He was what Mr. Grew had dreamed of being. And so precise, so detailed, was Mr. Grew's vision of his own imaginary career, that as Ronald grew up and began to travel in a widening orbit, his father had an almost uncanny sense of the extent to which that career was enacting itself before him. At Harvard, Ronald had done exactly what the hypothetical Mason Grew would have done, had not his actual self, at the same age, been working his way up in old Slagden's button factory, the institution which was later to acquire fame and even notoriety as the birthplace of crew secure suspender buckle. Afterward, at a period when the actual crew had passed from the factory to the bookkeeper's desk, his invisible double had been reading law at Columbia, precisely again what Ronald did. But it was when the young man left the paths laid out for him by the parental hand, and cast himself boldly on the world, that his adventures began to bear the most astonishing resemblance to those of the unrealized Mason crew. It was in New York that the scene of this hypothetical being's first exploits had always been laid, and it was in New York that Ronald was to achieve his first triumph. There was nothing small or timid about Mr. Crewe's imagination. It had never stopped at anything between Wingfield and the metropolis. And the real Ronald had the same cosmic vision as his parent. He brushed aside with a contemptuous laugh his mother's tearful entreaty that he should stay at Wingfield and continue the dynasty of the Crewe suspender buckle. Mr. Crewe knew that in reality Ronald winced at the buckle, loathed it, blushed for his connection with it. Yet it was the buckle that had seen him through Groton, Harvard, and the law school, and had permitted him to enter the office of a distinguished corporation lawyer, instead of being enslaved to some sordid business with quick returns. The buckle had been Ronald's fairy godmother, yet his father did not blame him for abhorring and disowning it. Mr. Crewe himself often bitterly regretted having bestowed his own name on the instrument of his material success, though, at the time, his doing so had been the natural expression of his romanticism. When he invented the buckle and took out his patent, he and his wife both felt that to bestow their name on it was like naming a battleship or a peak of the Andes. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.